Hey. Yeah, I'm Buzz Baum. I'm at UCL, and in fact, just to say, my new obsession is actually evolution of the cytoskeleton, which I can tell you about if you're interested. But yeah, I'm interested also in morphogenesis and cells, cell shape.
All right, just a few announcements. After the talk, 12:15, Andy will be doing the Blackboard lunch seminar, and if you remember what that is, it's an opportunity for programs, the different programs at KITP, to tell each other about what the programs are about. And then in the evening at 5:00, we have wine and cheese. And at 8:00, for the students, I'll be giving some mechanics lecture. So again, this evening at 8:00, so I'll see you back here. Otherwise, welcome, Buzz. You have an hour and a half.
Okay.
And, thank you.
But yeah, so I don't remember everybody's names, but what you were, interrupt and tell me your name. So it's really great to be back and amongst so many people interested in morphogenesis and mechanics, which is not always the case in biology. And today I thought I'd tell you about two stories from the lab. Both relate to what we've called tissue refinement, which is how a tissue becomes ordered at the end of development. And my lab, I mean, I've always been interested in cells, and so that's why, for me, everything always was the cellular perspective. I guess that's why I've got this picture is, in a way, for me, I'm a biologist, I don't understand much about physics except what I learned, fighting with my brothers as kids, and I suppose that's what this is represents is. And I always think that, in a way, tissues are really cells made from cells that are the architects, the bricks, and everything of tissues. And tissues are made through cells communicating, fighting, pulling on each other. And that's why I chose this as my first slide. In fact, the other reason also is because actually I first many of us are interested in self-organization. Again, that's not often typical in biology, but I know physics people always talk about self-organization, but I think one of the people who helped us understand the importance of self-organization was Sasai, who was one of the people who showed that you could take a single stem cell and put it in a leave it in suspension, it would form an I cup in vitro, showing that if you give cells enough room, they can do it themselves. Again, cells juggling, fighting with each other can build tissues. And I think that's a very important insight. So in the lab, we don't work on mouse or eyes or stem cells. What we work on, as you probably have heard from other people, we work on fly epithelia, and in particular the notum, the back of the fly. And we chose that because it's a beautiful, simple tissue. It's, of course, incredibly complicated, and lots of things happen, but it is a monolayer epithelium, where at the stage and area we study it, not much happens, in fact. The tissue, in terms of shape and size, doesn't change much, but you can see that lots of things do happen. All the cells in the tissue divide once, which is very important, so they start off big, and they end up smaller because they all divide once. In addition, you have, at the end of development, you have two cell types, which you can see, which are these ones are going to become mechanosensory organs, the ones which express GFP under a promoter for neuralized, and the other cells are going to become epithelial cells. And the other thing I hope you can see, if you look as it keeps looping, you can see that at the beginning, in fact, the tissue is cells of funny shapes, especially, in fact, this area, which is the midline of the tissue, where in fact is born out of, I'll show you in a minute, but where two tissues came together. And cells are quite disorganized. At the end, again, you get perfect packing in the middle, and you get perfect packing everywhere. I mean, I say perfect, but it's better. And we've actually shown that to be the case. So in a way, not much is happening. There's not much morphogenesis, which many people are interested in a way, that tissue is changing shape and size. But there's a lot happening to do with ordering a tissue and patterning a tissue to get the right cells in the right place and to order the tissue. So this is the system. Everything I'm going to tell you about is with this tissue. And we're going to be following the similar time period where we start with a tissue that's poorly patterned and a bit disorganized, and we end up with a tissue at the end, which is quite well ordered. And in fact, this animal will then hatch and fly, and the muscles of the animal, the fly, I can show you that in the next slide, actually. So this tissue is born out of the fusion of two wing discs, which come together. They fuse to form the midline, which is that funny area I showed you in the previous movie. and it has to be sealed and patterned, and it has to be perfect because the wing muscles are going to attach underneath, and so when the fly flaps, it's going to put force onto this tissue. So it really has to be a uniform, mechanically uniform epithelium, which needs to support flight. And the bristles are mechanosensory bristles. I mean, I think that nobody's done work, as far as I know, to show that they're really important for flight. They might be, but also for cleaning the animal, and they're sort of, again, beautifully plain and polarized, but quite simple. So it's in a way a very simple monoel epithelium, which is interacting with other tissues like muscles, and has to be patterned in a simple way, maybe to help flight, or maybe to help cleaning, etc. Okay, so the two, yes, Boris.
What brings the two discs together in panel B?
How do they find each other?
Yeah.
So one of the things, this is this, Kafkaesque process of metamorphosis, where you're remodeling the whole body, and the discs have to sort of find each other and fuse together. And the trouble is, it happens in this gloopy pupa, so it's quite hard to image. And so it's been described how it happens. Maybe some people like Marcus know more about it than me, but essentially, I think it happens a bit like this, but it's quite hard to image. So people haven't got, but it looks like you have protrusions and tissue pulls itself together. Interestingly, you always get, it is interesting that the fly is really built in these two halves, and they come together and seal. And the midline is really in the middle. So one thing we always want to do, actually, is to slow growth on one side and see whether the middle shifts. But I think there's something that the larval tissue, which is replaced by the discs, is probably also contains patterning information, which is then used when the tissue comes together. And so, for example, in a bit lower down in the abdomen here, you have all these histoblast nests that will destroy the larval tissue as they fuse. So it's sort of a slightly different process. So it's quite amazing. Yeah.
But are you saying that the larval epithelium is involved in any of the fusion?
No. But in the abdomen it is. So it's sort of interesting. Yes. Yes. So in a way, that's what's in. I suppose this. Yeah. It's, I think, quite a mysterious process. Yeah. Yeah, how you? I think that's a fascinating evolution question. How you do this switch where you have these metamorphoses intervening in development is a really cool question. Not many people work on it. So anybody who wants a future in biology, that would be a good thing to work on. So the two things I'm going to talk about today is one is about how you refine a pattern, how you get a sort of messy non-patterned tissue, which is starting to pattern, how you get a beautiful pattern. And then next thing, and the second part is going to be about how you optimize the packing so that cells are quite nicely packed at the end of development. And these, again, are pictures from Barbara Hepworth, who, he's a great British artist, but I always think they have a sort of biological feeling to them. That's why he's... So, everybody ready for part one? So if you, as you would have seen from the movies, when you start development, earliest time you can image, before the whole thing is a gloopy pupil mess, what you can do is you can open a window in the pupil case, put a cover slip on top and image. And before that, before the tissue is fused, it's hard to do that. You can, but it's difficult. So we typically image as early as we can, but when the head is formed and it's all solid. And then at that early time point, what you see is you see cells start to express these this driver, suggesting cells are starting to become bristle precursor cells. They're going to become bristles, these organs. And so cells start to express these markers. And what you can see is the pattern is quite messy. And at the end, this is the same tissue a while later, and the pattern is now fully formed and the animal will hatch and these will become bristles. So the question we were sort of interested in is how do you get this sort of messy initial pattern and refine it to get this beautiful end pattern? And when we just followed cells just in time, so typically, actually, in this area, this work in the lab, we just typically begin by just looking at movies, which I think is good, and many biologists do that, but I think it's how we get our inspiration away. So we just wondered what happens, and what we saw is that some cells appear to start off like they're expressing some reporter, like they're going to become a bristle cell, and then they switch it off, and so they change state. There are a few cells that actually leave the tissue, and that's something we've looked at a bit, but I'm not going to talk about that today. And there are some cells that actually just seem to remain in place, pretty much. There's a bit of shifting, but not much. And so you can see here, it's like looking at stars. Patterns. This is the Cassiopeia. Basically, they sort of remain in place. So as a sort of try to get a better measure of order for this, we just did a very, very simple thing, which I think we often do in the lab, is just to measure the spacing between cells in rows. So you'll notice, actually, that there is patterning also in rows. So we're going to ignore that. So what we're going to do is we're going to treat the system like, when we do measurements, we're always going to measure cells in rows. Because in fact, the rows, there is another pattern superimposed on this that I'm not going to talk about, where you do pattern the rows. And so rows come up at slightly different times. And so typically we look at one row at a time. When you measure the spacing between cells in a row, you can measure the distance between cells and the variation. And what you can see is that early on in development, the average distance between cells is quite low, as you can see. But there's also a big variation, so it's very, very messy. And at the end of development, you get quite a big spacing between cells, and the variation is quite low. So we would say it's becoming ordered at quite a large scale. So how is this process regulated? So the great thing about flies, which David said is the best system, one of the best systems, is that there's 100 years of research in genetics with mutants that affect many processes, including this kind of process, how you make bristles. And I think Bridges was the first one in 1915 or something who identified some of the mutants that affect bristles and wing shape. And the pathway that does it is very famous. It's called the Notch Delta pathway. And essentially the idea is that cells in the tissue express a ligand, which is delta, and other cells express a receptor, which is called notched. When the two meet each other, and in fact, you have to do a bit of pulling, which I'll talk about at the end. You have to pull a bit. If you pull a bit, essentially then you cleave the notched reporter. It then goes into the cytoplasm and into the nucleus, because it's got a nuclear localization sequence. It then changes gene expression. And in fact, switches off the expression of delta, which is one of the things it does. So a cell that receives a notch signal switches off delta, meaning so there's more delta. And the other cell will endocytose and recycle the delta. And there's lots of papers where people have shown that's how that works. And more recently, actually, people have shown that you do need probably a little bit of pulling to get that to work, which is quite interesting. So what this does in a tissue is you have two equivalent cells, which are born with the same amount of notch and delta. When they speak to each other, what will happen is there's a kind of competition. Because if you remember, the cell that gets a notch signal, so that gets notch is activated, so delta signals to notch is activated, cleaved, goes into the nucleus, that will switch off, as I said, delta expression. So the more notch signal you get, the less delta you have. And the two things are competing, and in the end what happens is there's symmetry breaking, and one cell will get will essentially switch off delta expression and become a notch expressing cell, and the other one will switch off notched and will just express delta. And so the two cells will switch fate. And this one will become a bristle cell, and this will become an epithelial cell. So it's a way, and this has been described a long time ago by Colleen Lewis and with Nick Monk, helped to do this. And essentially, the idea is, that expressed mathematically, you can correct me, if you look at the rate of change of notched, it depends on the amount of delta that comes in, and the rate of change of delta with this is decay terms, and if you look at the amount of delta in a cell, the more notched that's activated, the less delta you have. So if you run these equations in simulations, what you get is you have equivalent cells that break symmetry, and one in the end, sorry, the color change, one in the end it will express more notched, and the other one would be delta, and be a stable configuration. So many years ago, when Michael Cohen came to the lab and started interested in the notum patterning, he just ran simulations, and this is what they look like. So essentially, this is where we took the cell packing from a picture of a tissue, and we ran the simulations of notched delta patterning on this tissue. What we saw is that you get beautifully spaced bristle cells in a tissue, very much like we saw in the animal. But of course, there are a few problems. Anybody want to say? What's one problem? Yeah, so one thing is the spacing is clearly way off. These are well spaced. Anything else somebody can see?
rose.
The rose. Oh, yeah, so one thing we haven't imposed the rose, that's true. Yeah. So one other thing that we noticed, which is a bit subtle, is that actually, interestingly, often in the model, actually, what you see is that the small cells tend to become delta-expressing cells because they've got less neighbors, and so they tend to get less inhibited. So, whereas actually in the tissue, that's not the case. The big cells, in fact, they tend to be bigger, the ones in the tissue, have delta. And the other thing that happens is that, as you might imagine, if you run the simulation, you have symmetry breaking. So any cell that expresses slightly more delta than its neighbor will immediately destined to become a delta-expressing SOP cell, whereas the other ones will are fixed. So in fact, if you run this simulation, it goes immediately to endpoint without any doubt. And as I showed you in the first movies, in the tissues, what we saw is cells actually seem to change their mind a lot, and so you never get that in these simulations. So the key things is that the spacing, the rows are gone, the size of cells are a bit different, and key thing is that really, the kinetics of patterning is different. So as I said, in the model, everything happens very quickly as fixed, but in the tissue, there seems to be this refinement where you change pattern, which I said was interesting. So the reason actually we got interested in these cells was originally, in fact, was not because we were that interested in patterning. It's really because we were cell biologists wanted to study cells. And because you can label them with GFP, what you can do is you can see one of these cells in a tissue without seeing all the epithelial cells. So it's very good for cell biology. And so when we started doing this, what we noticed, so we could start image, if you just label these cells and you don't label the epithelial cells with GFP, you can see the whole shape of these cells. So we could study how they get their shape. And interesting, they're not like columns or bricks in a tissue, which we always thought epithelial cells were bricks as an approximation. They're not. They're more like, in a way, trees in a forest, where everybody always, with epithelial, they always look apically because it's beautifully organized, where you have this actomyosin at the apical surface. But basically, it's a complete mess. I don't know if you can see that. But you have all these protrusions underneath, like the roots of trees in a forest. So that immediately suggested that, that in a way, cells might... who we think are your neighbors, if you're in a tissue, might be different in reality to what you see in the tissue. And so, for example, here we have a picture of three cells in the tissue, which are actually very far apart, apically. And what we saw is over time, this one would disappear to leave these with the correct spacing. And so it seemed very mysterious, but actually you just look underneath, and it's very simple. Actually, these cells are touching all the time. And so maybe they're competing, basically, because through these protrusions. Oh, yeah, so it's just it's an actin marker, actually, but we do lots of different markers. This is actually, it's an actin.
Yeah. You're going to talk about the dynamics of these?
Yeah. That's it. So in fact, what we see, in fact, is that this is a basal plane, and it's quite hard to see. This is a sim image with superposition, and they have these very nice fine protrusions, and we actually have seen notch and delta on them. I can show you pictures if people are interested. And what you see is these very dynamic protrusions. And what happens is actually, after the cells divide, the protrusions disappear when it differentiates. But essentially, there's a period of the whole development before cells divide and their fate is sealed, where they have all these protrusions going in different directions. And you can see the cells have like between 5 and 10 protrusions, and they're, I mean, depends on how thick you define them, but they're, so these cells actually wouldn't touch if you looked apically, but basically, of course, there's lots of potential for transient interactions, and they will interact with all the cells around. And importantly, although again I'm not showing it here, the neighboring epithelial cells have the same protrusions. So when you stain with actin, all you see is a total mess, which is why, in a way, people don't talk about them much, these protrusions. But you have to label individual cells to see that. Yes?
The protrusions of the precursors
are
not biased towards each other?
No, yes, we couldn't see any bias in protrusions. But I think it's a very interesting question whether, I mean, it is something the system could do. So you could planar polarize protrusions to change patterning, so in some tissues. But we haven't, in this system, we haven't seen that. Some other people have reported.
So what is the range?
Yeah, it's actually between it's like two cell diameters of that order.
So is that enough to explain the spacing in bristles? Because every dark cell has to have the delta neighbor.
So what we did is so one thing we did. May I just? Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. So what we did is we. First of all, we just tested what happens if you shorten the protrusions. And because we'd studied cell shape, we knew some of the genes that you can do that. So if you remove this protein scar wave complex, cells can't make... In fact, interestingly, all the cell biologists in the world, including me, always thought that RAC scar make lamellipodia. Maybe you heard this. You know, CT42 makes filipodia. In vivo, not the case. If you want to make these long filipodia, you need wave and you need RAC. Anyway, we can discuss that another time. But essentially, if you remove scar, you get less protrusions and the spacing changes. And we can also do another experiment, which maybe is sort of related to Boris's question, where we can switch off RAC in the cells, just the SOP cells, but not in the neighbors. Because, as I said, these cells have protrusions and these cells have protrusions. So you want to know whether protrusions have to touch for cells to signal, or whether cell protrusion could touch the cell body of another cell to signal.
Of course, yeah. RAC and all these actions also involve in apical platform that happen. You know, it's not only basal.
Oh no, of course, yeah. In fact,
and that is a lot to do with the signaling and endocytosis.
And in fact, also, I mean, one thing I can mention is that also myosin. There's actually quite a lot of myosin, basally, which people don't study, which is sort of project we're beginning. Well, Ginger, who's left the lab, is working on now, which is about how myosin is involved in this. Yeah.
Perhaps in your last slide, but is the delta not, are the delta not receptors, are they localized to? You're going to get to that.
Presumably. Well, yes. I'm not going to get there too much. I mean, basically, we do see... The thing is, there's lots and lots of delta notched, like, apically.
Yes.
Which you can see. But there is some basally. And the question is... maybe I can talk about this. So the question is that whether that's sufficient to induce changes in organization, a small signal. And it depends how you set it up. But the interesting thing is that... So basically, if you have no protrusion signaling, the only way cells can signal to each other is just by lateral interfaces, which will touch. And that means that because it's a system that's breaking symmetry, if you have a small, and Michael, when he was doing this project, he did like 1/1,000th of the signal is sent basally. But because it's a bias, actually, because the system is symmetric, even that small basal signal can actually... change the spacing, because it just allows cells to compete. So you don't need much signal, but we don't know how much happens basally. And the one thing that Ginger's been looking at, which I think is really interesting, which I don't have much data on today, but we are looking at, is that, as I mentioned at the beginning, one cool thing about notch and delta signaling is you require pulling.
Right.
It's been shown to be mechanically activated. So it might be that these protrusions, not only do they go out to let cells signal, but then when two cells touch, it might pull. And so one thing Ginger's doing is trying to make these sort of fret sensors to see if you can see notch and delta pulling, to see whether the other function of these might be to generate forces. And if that's the case, that might enable you to be even better at signaling than you were with lateral interfaces, where signaling is often driven by endocytosis forces, but maybe myosin pulling forces would be different. So that's something we don't really know much about, but we're sort of Ginger is investigating. Yes.
If you image the other cells, do they also have filipodia?
Yeah, so it looks actually very different. I mean, it's a bit hard to do because you have to make clones and things to look at the edge of a clone, but they look very similar. We couldn't detect a difference. So what we tried to do then is
Is there any role for Shibiri in the basal lateral membrane to these cells?
So this is why what Ginger's been doing actually is looking at endocytosis versus myosin forces in generating signaling in protrusions. So one thing actually in protrusions, there isn't that much, we can't really see endocytosis, and in very thin ones it's unlikely to get clathrin-mediated endocytosis. And we haven't been able to see, so when we reduce myosin levels, the spacing changes, suggesting that myosin forces are required for patterning, which I've got other slides for not today. When you perturb endocytosis, you also get changes in patterning, but the two appear to be in parallel, so they're additive. And we've done the same things in cell culture as well, actually. So that this is sort of a bit of an aside for the people who work on this, but it seems to be that endocytosis pulling forces, where you delta's endocytosed and maybe pull, seem to be additive to myosin. But of course, you might need myosin on a membrane, on a cortex, to make the membrane non-deformable, so you could actually generate forces with endocytosis. So we're not sure how it works. Yes, Boris.
That one we see that the spacing, let's say vertically, by saying panel C,
yes,
has not changed nearly as much as the spacing horizontally. And you already said that there is the
yes, stripes,
of,
yeah.
Stripes. So this is saying that the stripes are laid down by different mechanisms.
Well, that's a really good point. So interestingly, in this tissue, we can't image the emergence of stripes. But in fact, notch delta is involved in stripe emergence. And so in a way, you'd have to go into the abdomen where you can actually see notch delta stripes being laid down. And that's something we were interested in doing, but other people have been doing it, so we didn't do that. But I think, yeah, how you get this spacing is interesting. We did though, find that with these scar clones, we did get some changes in the spacing between, but we have to. But temporally, it's an earlier process. So probably, I think what you do is lay down the lines, but notch and delta could be involved in that, and then you lay down So you sort of make a grid. You make the roads this way first, and then you break it up this way. That's how we think.
Oh, so there were cell divisions in between. So maybe when they were laid down, they're actually much closer together.
Growth. Well, you have to have growth because division just makes everything smaller. Well, actually, in this stage, yes, yeah, so there might have been divisions before, and I'm not sure when. Again, Marcus might be able to help me, but I'm not sure when the lines are set down. It's possible there might be a division that separates to the patterning this way, which would be cool actually, because the next part I'm going to talk about cell division. But we don't know that. But at this stage, this whole patterning process I'm talking about is happening, as you'll see in a while, in an extended G2 phase where cells are waiting before dividing. When they divide, the pattern is fixed.
I mean, Francois has now his endogenous delta and notch.
Yeah.
And there he sees the all these stripes emerging.
Yeah, the one, yeah.
By
yeah.
Intercalation. And this happens yeah. before this.
Yeah, it's a bit before. Well, it's actually not, yeah, so not so much before, but yeah. So just to say, so what we did is what Michael did is he made a model in 1D just to try and model the cells in a stripe. And what he did is he put in the filipodia length, and then he put in the range of cell sizes based upon the ones we imaged, and he just measured the predicted spacing in the model if you have protrusion signaling. And what he found is that protrusion signaling can explain, the model can explain the spacing that you see between cells pretty well. And it also, what was nice is that with the RAC perturbation, these cells send shorter protrusions, but the receiving cells have protrusions. And there he found that also we could get quite good match. And if we shorten protrusions, like we saw in SCAR, of both the receiver and the sending cells, we could also match quite well. So it's not proof, but it suggests that the model can recapitulate the spacing we see based upon protrusions, if protrusion signaling is the key thing. And I would say that we're quite convinced, other people in the field still think it's controversial, which is fair enough. So that suggested that at least this model of protrusions was quite a plausible explanation for the spacing of cells in the tissue. And the other thing that I really liked about the model is the model also enabled us to study the role of protrusion dynamics. So of course that's to do with the length, and of course the longer you are, the bigger the spacing. So you can imagine evolution again. One project I always wanted to do was to go to like a museum and go through all the fly collections and see whether you could find different, you know, related species with different spacing. You could then go back and see whether protrusion lengths are predictive of that. We didn't do that. But essentially with the model, what you could do is ask whether protrusion dynamics are important. And what was nice is that if you take a model of notch delta signaling and you put in first of all, if you put in fixed filipodia, so they're made and they don't not dynamic, you get quite a good pattern actually, which is very similar if the protrusions are very, very dynamic. And that's because all the cells are sampling their entire environment all the time. So they're always seeing all their neighbors, and you get a pattern that's fixed very quickly. There's no refinement, no change. Everybody knows what everybody else is, and you stop. If you have very slow filipodia dynamics, then what happens is that cells see their neighbors, and then everybody's protrusions change. And then you see another set of neighbors, and so cells change fate. And in fact, what happens is the pattern never stabilizes, because cells are always changing who they're speaking to. So protrusion dynamics can have an impact. And what we noticed is that if we take an intermediate condition, where you have intermediate dynamics, what happens is that initially the pattern is not very good. This is sort of variation in the pattern. So if you fix Philopodia, it's quite constant, as I said, it happens quickly and it's constant. But if you have slow protrusion intermediate, what happens is the pattern gets better and better and better and better over time. And cells which are uncertain of their fate will eventually can often reposition them. And in fact, this cell, I think, the one of them will win and one of them will lose. And often it's the one that's best placed. So the pattern actually gets better. So this outperforms fixed Philopodia as an algorithm. So what they suggested, which was quite nice, again, is a sort of hypothesis, because we couldn't separate, unfortunately, length and dynamics. We'd like to be able to do that experimentally, but we didn't. Couldn't. But maybe in the future one could. It suggested that the dynamics themselves are important because they add noise to the system that enables the system to explore different variants of the pattern to settle on a pattern that's a very good pattern and then stop. So we sort of like this idea that protrusions give you several things. They give you spacing, but they also give you noisiness, which is important to enable this refinement, annealing of the pattern. Yes?
Is your model on the fixed triangular lattice, or is the actual dynamics of the cells involved as well?
No, we just put it on a completely fixed lattice. Yeah, we didn't do these kind of things. Yeah, we just did the simplest possible case. And you'll see we did, this is a 2D, we did this in 2D, but which is an approximation of the tissue, because in the animal it's in stripes. Yes.
Question about timescales. There's a timescale associated with delta notch kinetics.
Yes.
There's timescales associated with Philopodia extension and retraction.
Yeah.
And then there's timescales associated with rearrangement of the lattice, typical times as you previous T1, like that.
Yeah.
Just ballpark.
Yeah.
The relative sizes of those different timescales.
So I think
the one I don't know is the delta notch one. I don't know what that is in your.
Yeah, well, you'll see in the next thing about the demo. So maybe we can. It looked like it was plausible anyway. So the timescale of protrusions, they last for several minutes. Mm-hmm. Like the timescale of patterning is. Now we think we know by looking at is over a few hours, but not that long. So that kind of intermediate thing is the kind of one which we're trying to model here, and it looks like that can do the job. But of course, and the last part of the talk will be about neighbor exchange, and you'll see that's actually not very high. In fact, that's lower. So I think, but it could be one could go back and really do it, try to match properly the tissue and recapitulate, but we haven't done that yet.
On your solution, also, is the length of the Philopodia, like maximum length, defined and fixed? Or?
Yes, so we actually have a distribution of lengths, which is based upon the ones we measured. And they have between 5 and 10 Philopodia, and they have a range of lengths that are the ones we measured, which is what we used in the slide before. Yeah.
That will define also the pattern, I guess.
Yes, maybe you and then.
I don't know if you said it, but the animal pattern, is it also at that optimized length scale?
Say again?
The original pattern in the animal, is that also at the minimum length? Like, are the cells also at the minimum spacing?
Oh, when the pattern first forms?
Yeah.
When it first emerges, you mean?
Yeah.
That's quite hard to... In fact, interestingly, the initial pattern is set is quite perplexing in a way, because you get... So there are some, it's a bit messy, and often, in fact, you will get even adjacent cells come up together. So it does suggest that early on they're not seeing each other. So it's almost like, in fact, that's related to maybe the next thing, the way the game starts, so you start playing where everybody has to speak to each other and see who's going to come notch and delta, is the initial conditions we don't know so well. And it's interesting because it's quite hard to understand, because you do get these doublets of cells or even three in a row. And so it looks like there might be pre-patterns, but also it might be that cells are not playing at all, and then everybody plays. And I think that would be interesting to look at. We haven't done it. Yes?
Once the pattern is set, do you still have more divisions?
So I'm going to talk about division now, so maybe you can ask me. Okay. So having done that stuff, and actually that's published, you can read about it. quite a while ago now. And what Ginger did, so Ginger's now working in NIH Bethesda, and she's looking for group lead independent positions. But she's been continuing with this work, and she's been using these notch delta reporters from which Leahy generated in the Perryman lab. And what's nice is you can actually see the kinetics of notch delta signaling in the tissue now as it emerges, which is really quite beautiful. So, I mean, you can see, for example, the stripes, which is what Marcus was saying, which you see here. And the other thing you can see is that you can actually follow. So what we're looking at is cells which have a neuralized reporter. So we can see as they start to switch on the fate to become sensory organ precursors. And we can see also the not active notch signal state come on. And because the markers, which are using a fast folding and destabilized, you can see cells as they change their mind because their GFP comes and then is turned over. It's not perfect kinetics because you have to wait for it to fold and degrade it, but you get some quite good kinetics. And what you can see, I mean, is that you see the pattern emerge. So it's getting brighter and brighter because these cells are getting more and more of the accumulating notched reporter because over time, because they're getting a notched signal, and these ones have none. But what you can see is there's a few cells like this one where actually you can see some cells that have both reporters early on. And so what we can do is say, if you look at the early part of the period, you can say, how do you get to become a particular cell of a particular state? And what we see is that there are SOP cells, these cells that become red, often actually express quite a lot of the notch reporter early. And then there's sort of fluctuations, and then eventually they become an SOP cell, so they express the neuralized, and it comes on very, very high. And then once that's happened, it's not going to change its mind. But we get other cells, these are the switching ones, these are the yellow ones, where they actually look like they're going to become an SOP cell, and then the reporter disappears and they end up becoming an epithelial cell. So we really see them switching fate. And that's something we sort of thought we saw before, but we couldn't, it was harder to prove, but now we can actually see these cells changing their mind. And I think that's really important in biology. Often, I mean, you guys probably all know that, but often if you read the literature, you think that cells die or cells change state. But of course, it takes time to change. You don't just flick a switch, you have to change. So the dynamics of these processes are not that well studied, and again, very interesting. So these cells are changing the fate. And of course, we have epithelial cells, many of these cells, that just, they know that they've got a strong notch signal, they're going to become epithelial cells. And
so should we take notice of the fact that those one and two are very different times at which you first see
Yeah, that's a good question. We do get some, I mean, in fact, it isn't, so you can get cells that switch quite late. And we also did previously, if you do a BLAT1, neighboring cells can come up. So there is a possibility of changing. So the trouble is maybe the numbers of these are not that high. So, but I think it's a question worth asking is what proportion of these are happening at which time and whether there is a sort of time period of which, you know, these cells become. But we do think it looks quite fluid. So you can have cells that actually look quite strong, you know, maybe ones up here, actually have quite strong expression of neurons, and they'll still switch phase actually and come down. And it probably depends a bit on the local environment, who you're competing with locally.
Alternative is something else has happened.
Yeah.
That if you get neuralized after that
yeah.
time point.
Yeah, we don't think so. It does look like it's sort of, you can see them early and late. But of course, as time goes on, you see less and less. But we have seen some at very late periods that change their mind, actually. Yeah.
So are you saying that it's not just the absolute level of, let's say, delta, but the ratio of delta to notch in the cell that matters? I vaguely remember the story from Caltech, Elowitz and friends
right.
making a rather big deal of lateral inhibition.
Yeah.
Right. So signaling on the same cell surface.
Yes, cis versus true. Yeah, yeah.
See some overlap in.
So I think we're not seeing. I think in this case we do think it's more to do with the environment. So often you can see. I mean, that, for example, in this instance, you have this cell which is changing its mind. It's quite close to one that's coming up actually a bit later. So this has, I think, slightly more the neuralized signal than its neighbor, but the neighbor is sort of better placed, and maybe this one is being... So we think it's more to do with you are actually... You could go either way. I mean, there could also be cis inhibition. In the models we've looked at, if you express notch and delta and you have cis inhibition, it just sharpens your switches.
So can you make that the quantitative statement sort of conditional on the cell's switching fate? You can ask how close are they to a delta?
At which level? Yeah. I suppose, yeah.
Will you always see if there is a delta nearby, or is it just the just cell structure?
I think it all pretty much is, but again, maybe we should. The numbers are not enormous, so like you might have like 20 per notum, so maybe we'd have to go back, or 10, so maybe we'd have to go back and do. But it's what I think that's a really. I think we haven't dug enough into the switching. I totally agree, actually, that they're really interesting questions, like both you and James are bringing up, that we should look at. Yeah, Nick.
I'm not sure if this is just semantics. I don't think it is, though. Why do you call a change in the level of neuralized expression a switch in fate?
So it's a change
in the signaling.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think... basically, we have looked at other markers. So originally, we looked at, like, all these, like, cuts and all these lots of other potential markers and showed that it's not just one marker. It's obviously a whole range. But, of course, that's just a set of... in a way, maybe what I'm saying is that maybe fate is the wrong word, because essentially it is just all these signaling pathways being activated at slightly different levels, and there will be a fate because the cell will do one thing or the other. But to say at any minute, what the cell fate is hard based upon its expression level. In a way, I'm maybe saying the same thing. So I think the question of when the fate is sealed, what I'm saying in this case, we think from looking at them, is that. It really depends on your environment. So, in fact, you couldn't even define a set of signaling levels that would define fate, because, in fact, fate is a product of the environment. And so, in fact, yeah, so maybe that would be an important question. If that was formalized and quantified, you could try and say that the genes expressed by a cell do not determine its fate, because it depends on, this context. Yeah. Yes.
Is there a dynamics of the proneural gene, independent global dynamics of the pre-pattern independently?
Yeah. There's lots of patterning of, for example, that in stripes we did talk about things like if we inhibited any possibility of differentiation, whether you could start to see, like, if there's oscillations or things. But we haven't seen anything. But again, I think... we probably haven't looked enough to really...
The question is that, the fate can be decided quite early or not, depending
Definitely, we do see... we know fate is flexible, because if you kill a cell, the neighbours will change fate. So there's definitely flexibility in the system, for sure. And it's mirrored by these kind of processes. So we do think this is not just an epiphenomenon. It really is, the cell is actually doing something to do with it. It could have done one thing and is doing something else.
What would be the defect of fate? Would be
If you remove all signaling, then everybody's going to become going to express delta, because you're. Yeah.
But that's only up to a stage.
Many drosophila epithelia, you break them all apart, they all become neuroblasts, or, they're all...
Sure, but if you do it late enough,
yeah, no, we haven't done that yet. Yeah. All we've done is try to kill a few cells and see.
I'm just wondering, at what stage are you killing the few cells? Is it after most, like...
Yeah. So we've only... Yeah, so actually, again, that was a bit hard to do, so we did it in the middle period. And so, again, we would have liked to have said, and I think it's good, we would have liked to have said, if you kill 20 cells every stage, at what stage is fate determined? We didn't do that yet, which maybe would, that would be helpful. Okay, so the other thing we noticed, actually, with this analysis, is that we could actually quantify notch reporter levels. And because we were interested in this idea of protrusion signaling, what we want to do is to measure notch reporter in the immediate neighbours, and the second neighbours, which should only be reached by protrusions. And these second neighbours, if you remember, because of the spacing are typically not contacted by directly by another SOP cell. So there's a set of first neighbors and second neighbors and some even tertiary cells that are quite far away from SOPs. There aren't any quaternary. There aren't any many cells in the tissue which are separated from any SOP by four cells. So what we can do then is look at the signaling in the first neighbors and second neighbors, and we can quantify that. And what we see is quite interesting is that using this notch reporter, is that we can see notch coming on in first and second neighbors with kinetics. In fact, the kinetics are... actually, I'll show you. Maybe I'll put all the data up. Essentially, what we can see is that as the... what happens is that the signal goes up in primary neighbors and secondary neighbors. Then what happens typically is the cell will divide, and once the cell divides, it's no longer in the game, so the notch, the signal tends to decay. So up to division, cells are competing and playing the game, and then once they divided, their fate is sealed, and we never saw any changes after after cell division. So at least in the normal case, we think that division ends the kind of signaling. And what we saw is that, in fact, the final level, I mean, this is the maximum, of first and second neighbors that they reach in terms of notch data signaling is quite similar. So it's quite similar maximum level. But the rate at which this is achieved is a bit different for the primary and secondary neighbors. So what tends to happen is that the primary neighbors, so this is time to division. So in fact, you have to go, so basically, this just enables us to see that When a cell starts to accumulate notch signal, when will it divide? What we find is that the signaling rate at which it increases is higher in the primary neighbors, as shown here, the rate, than it is in secondary neighbors here. Although this is true, it is also the case that if you take in a local neighborhood the ratio of primary and secondary neighbors as they divide, the primary neighbors do tend to have slightly more signal than the secondary neighbors, as indicated by an elevated ratio, 1.2 over primary over secondary. Yes?
You were saying that when there's the division kind of fixed the fate, right?
Yeah.
Could it be the other way around? Like, once it's fixed, then it divides?
Yes.
If you look at the signal, right, it seems that at the moment of division, well, it's normalized, but it seems that it's pretty much, well, I don't know when it's normalized, the signal.
So you mean once the cell...
Yeah, reach a given amount of signal, then it divides because the fate is fixed, right?
Yeah, so we think that's true. Okay. So essentially what we think is that, well, which I'll show you in the next, actually, the... So what we found is that actually, you know, that made it, maybe I should just say that because this is time to division, what's hard to see here is the timing of division itself across the whole tissue. And what we see actually that although this goes up first, higher, but in fact these cells also divide first. So if you take cells in the tissue, the cells that are receiving a higher notch signal that goes up quicker, that whole signal ramping up occurs earlier, and they divide earlier than the neighbors. So that suggested to us that maybe, just as you suggested, that when the notch signal increases, that drives cells into division, which then ends their ability to play the game. And we can see that here. So interestingly, in the tissue, the SOP cells, which are the ones that are driving patterning, they're the last cells to divide. So they divide at 400 minutes. The first neighbors, which are the cells right next to them, divide much earlier. And they're the ones that get this strong notch signal, notch activation, T delta. For the epithelial cells, so if you take the neighbors of epithelial cells as a control, so you take an epithelial cell and its neighbor, they divide at the same time, suggesting the time, which is what you expect if the notch signal was driving division. So that's for control. And what's nice is, in fact, the cells that change their mind, which expressed a little bit of delta, and then switched it off, a little bit of the reporter, the neuralized reporter, and then switched it off, their neighbors actually divide a bit earlier than the epithelial cells, suggesting that that signal was functional because it was enough to tell their neighbors, I'm thinking of becoming a delta-expressing cell, divide, and so those cells tend to be pushed into vision a bit earlier. So that suggested to us that, again, that was one bit of evidence that the cells that are expressing these reporters are capable of functionally doing something that an SOP cell can do. They can drive their neighbors to divide slightly earlier. Yes?
So you said that there are no real quaternary cells, right, which have which are separated by four orders. So the third order is then receiving inputs from two SOPs in some sense?
Or it's quite far away, and maybe it could become an SOP, or maybe it's positioned. Yeah, there weren't so many of those, so we don't have good statistics. But you could say, if you're surviving as a tertiary, one of these cells at three away, you might say, well, it should be expressing. If we're right about self-organization, it should be expressing the neuralized. If it's not, then you'd predict that it's somehow equidistant from multiple SOPs, which is why, and we didn't do that because we'd need numbers, but that's a good, very good question. Yeah. So many things to do. Ginger's taking this project on, so I'll tell her. So the other thing, so that suggests that the notch signal may be driving cells into division. So to test that, what we did is we expressed suppressive hairless RNAi, which is something that is the transcription factor that reads out the notch signal and activates genes and inhibits, for example, delta, this, well, part of this machinery. And if you express that, what happens is that you can delay division quite profoundly in the tissue of primary and secondary neighbors. And the difference between primary and secondary neighbors is also reduced. So it suggests that it is the case that if you don't have active notch signaling, division is delayed in supporting this idea. And if we express a delta dominant negative in the tissue through the neuralized promoter, what happens is that the signal was delayed and also reduced, the notch signal, suggesting that the signal is really to do with delta. So this is asking the question: if you just reduce with a dominant negative, if you reduce delta with a dominant negative in the cells that are sending a signal, does that affect the reception signal as you would predict? And it does reduce it somewhat, not completely, because it's just a dominant negative. And it delays it a bit, and these cells are also slightly delayed in division, suggesting that this thing we're seeing really might be the consequence of notched signaling leading to a change in division timing. Okay. So one thing is nice is that these cells actually, I didn't say that, well, I sort of mentioned briefly, but these cells are interesting because in development, this whole tissue, all the cells are in G2. So all in an extended period of G2, before mitosis, waiting to divide. And it's been shown by other people that, my referencing is not so good. I apologize for that. That the CDC25 promoter, which is a promoter of activation of the mitotic kinase, CDK1 cyclin B, has got binding sites for suppressive hairless. And so it's possible that it's quite direct pathway, and again, we didn't test that, we should, which is that notch signal comes in, suppressive hairless is activated, it binds to these sites, it activates CDC25 expression, which activates CDK1 cyclin B, which drives cells into division. So just to check genetically, we did the genetic experiment, to see whether CDC25, which is a phosphatase that removes the inhibitory phosphatase of WEE1 from CDK1 cyclin B, to see if this made sense in the tissue, we did string RNAi, which stops, kills this phosphatase, which is also called string. Apologize for the change in name. This is the same. If you reduce the levels of this, then actually now all the cells divide at the same time as the SOP. So that really suggests that CDC25 is acquired to drive early division. And we've already shown that the notch signal is acquired to drive early division. So it's possible that notch signal directly activates CDC25 to drive early division. And when we follow the notch reporter in a mutant where we don't have CDC25, what you see is, in fact, we get sustained notch signaling, we think, because normally division stops signaling. And if you in these cases where cells don't divide, in fact, the signal peaks higher than it does in the control, and it's sustained longer. It does eventually die down, so there might be it might also be switched off independently as the delta cells switch off the delta. this is the control where when you divide it goes down, and if you drive cells earlier into mitosis by removing WEE1 or MIT1, these kinases that do the counteracting thing, then you drive cells early into division and you don't peak as high and you lose much of the signaling.
But I'm going back to a question that was there before. What is the normalized signal? Normalized to what?
Sorry, this here, the type, the...
Well, in the right, in the ordinates, you write normalized, NSF, PSP signal. So that's normalized to what?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm asking
question.
Because in the pictures that you showed, it seems to me that the levels are not so amazingly homogeneous in the whole tissue you have. And I was wondering whether this normalization is actually getting rid of this effect. But in this case, then, if you interpret like levels of signaling would be in fact derivatives of signaling.
Maybe Zeno remembers. I think one thing is that a lot of these treatments, we use Panier and we use the non-Panier domain as a control. The other thing we do is that for all these measurements, for most of these things, we always looked in row 2. So we didn't use, because in fact all the different rows are different. So we use the same part of the tissue. And
but even within a row, you know, if you look at your pictures, there are variabilities. They are not all the same.
I think that's why most...
The relevance of it is that you are speaking the words of absolute levels of signaling.
No, so most of the time what we're talking about is, in all cases, we're measuring time to division. So for each cell, what happens is cells are dividing at different times. So if you remove that, so I think the major contribution in the noise, we would say, because division tends to happen at quite a reproducible maximum signal.
Is this true?
Therefore, that then you go back in time and actually...
Maximum means maximum levels, which is comparable between different cells, or the maximum level of that cell. Because again, that's the issue.
So it's a bit variable. So this is So let's Zena. So Zena helps us model. But what one thing we looked at is that if you look at the maximum so the mean cumulative expression is how much of the signal they've accumulated, but the ones that divide late, because they've been accumulating signal for much longer, have much higher accumulative levels of if you integrate over the whole time period.
Not absolute,
no, that's not absolute. But in fact, if you take the mean net expression at division, I mean, it's not. It's obviously you could look at it like this, or it's not so. It's much tighter than this. So again, actually, that's a key. I think again, that's something where we didn't do enough analysis, and we talked a lot about that. Actually, it was very hard to, in a way, inspired by your work, really thinking about what is the thing that's being measured about switching into division. And I think we were unsure, but it definitely was the case that the cumulative signal was not a good predictor, whereas the signal at division, which I had also in an earlier one with the stats, was actually quite. Yeah, was actually not so bad. But I mean,
the issue is normalized to what in this parameter?
Yeah.
The first time is 1, 2.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry, I can't remember. I can check the thing about exactly how we normalize it. Yeah. Yeah. So and Zena, correct me if I make errors. Basically, what we wanted to do was to just make a simple model of the system, just to see whether the coupling between not signaling and division might have consequences for the tissue, might have a simple consequences. And so what we did is that what Zena did is that we used our previous like notch delta, just the usual notch delta patterning thing that I talked about before, equations. And what we added was a probability of a cell dividing at any time point. And what we did is that because it seemed that cells, sort of when they get a certain level of expression, they switch into division, we use this probability term so that that when the reporter expression, i.e. notch signaling strength, went to a certain level, the cell would then go into division. And also this obviously has effect on patterning time, which is like what Madhav asked before. So we can talk about that in a second. But so essentially what we
I don't understand that.
Yes. The scatter plot. Yeah, sorry. So this is asking the question. The cells that developmental time across here. So what happens is that the cells that are dividing late in the tissue, they've actually been accumulating not reported for a long period of time. And if you look at their cumulative expression over time, it's got a degron, so it's turned over quite fast. But if you measure the cumulative expression over time, you integrate it, what you see is that the ones that divide late have been accumulating, not seen for a long period of time, so they have effectively very high cumulative level. But all we're saying is that irrespective of the time, and that's not completely true, as you can see, because it's a bit of a there is.
Yeah, that's what I was confused about.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
It
yes.
Looks like it's the later you divide.
It's slightly higher. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So we sort of said that it's more like this, more like a flat than it is like this. So we didn't look at that in detail. Yes, Zina.
So because that probability term is a Hill function and it allows cells, it means that you will divide with a given probability, so that cells that will, even if some cells will have a high signal and continue to increase their signal at the late times, but will end up, there's a probability that they will divide later, so they will end up having a higher signal just because there is a stochasticity effect whereby divide a bit later and then keep receiving the signal for longer. So it's not a threshold where you just have a signal and yet you just divide. Right. Yeah. So that effect is just through this.
Yeah. So
how do you fit that? Because then you need to be pulling numbers from some distribution as well to decide on.
So you have, you mean within the modeling framework?
Yeah.
So you have, for each individual cell, you can. You have its input delta from its neighbors, and then that will determine its notch over time, and then that will determine the probability of division.
But you need to fit the parameters to that, right? And you've also got a distribution you're then choosing from.
So the parameters are Q and K, R essentially,
yes.
Because R is the signal itself.
Yeah.
And
this is the signal, the other option.
Yeah. So you're right, we don't have measured values for Q and KR, but we've tried it for different values to see if the qualitative effect we get is different, and we generally get the same behavior.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's good. So basically, yeah, we haven't, so I think that was the, so I guess Zina was saying, yeah, that if you've been in the game longer because it's a probabilistic thing, you'll have more, but what we haven't done is gone back and really parameterized that. Madam?
Protein degradation time scales?
Sorry,
this seems to be my question every time. It's just time scales. Because basically,
yeah.
it limits the amount of cumulative effect, right?
Yeah. I mean, so in these curves, this is a mean curve, but if you look at for individual cells, we didn't do that. We didn't do a very quantitative fitting of that. But you can look at after cell divides, the decay, or if you switched off notch signaling, which you also did. The decay of the signal, which is, and you can see it's not very quick, but it does go down. Yeah, so we didn't fit expansions to that, so we didn't do that. Maybe we should. So at the moment, I would say it's a sort of toy model rather than a quantitative model, which it would be the next step. So essentially, what we saw is that fitting to that sort of simple idea. What we could do is then watch what happens in a tissue where we're not actually making cells divide in the lattice. All we're doing is saying once this cell is determined to divide, and division doesn't generate more mass, it just divides you in half. Essentially, what happens is that then you're no longer able to play the game. You're no longer able to send and receive signals. So essentially, what we see is that. You'll get cases where you might have two cells competing, one of them will divide, say, prematurely, and there it has to make a decision, and that will affect the other one's decision. So essentially, you can get these corrections through division. So basically what we could see is that when we put this modeling framework in place, which means that cells are signaling to each other by lateral interfaces, which give a strong signal, also protrusion-mediated signaling, that the notch input signal you get will affect the probability of dividing, and once you divide, you're taken out of the game. And so we can get patterning, you know, like we saw before. And we can see, of course, which is obvious, that because notch signal strength determines timing of division, that the primary neighbors of each SOP divide earlier than the secondary neighbors. And that gives you a bias in the relative timing.
And sorry to interrupt again.
Yeah.
So you've clearly got an edge effect here.
Oh, there's a massive edge effect, yeah.
So if you do this on a torus rather than a...
Yeah.
It's the same, it's just a lot slower.
So the edge is, so you're propagating from the edge in
openness. Yeah, but that's what I was doing initially, but I mean, it doesn't change the results, but it just makes the simulation slower because you have a...
Yeah, but that would be, yeah. In fact, the next page I've taken off the edge, so there is a very strong edge effect. So just to take it out. So basically, in the model, first neighbors divide before second neighbors. So the question in a way is that, yes?
That you also see the edge effects on the tissues in that you see lines that are closer to the edge dividing pairs and differentiating pairs,
right.
Because they have less competitors. So that's why you see the edge effects here.
Although in the tissue, in the tissue there are also cells that are set down early in some places which may actually seed the pattern. That's what we're going to see. So the question is, without the edge effect, which is that, so normally we're saying division is coupled to notch signaling. If you uncouple them, so now your probability of dividing is independent of your relationship to a neighbor. What happens is you get a sparse pattern. And that's because, we're looking at this, the reason there's a sparse pattern is because in order to do pattern refinement, you need cells that are these second neighbors which can come up if an SOP changes its mind. So you need a pool of cells which are not dividing but are capable of either fate in order to fill in the gaps in the model. And if you don't have those, by uncoupling signaling and cell division, you get these gaps. The other problem is that if you do the alternative where you divide, so SOPs, if you remember, they always divide last in the tissue. But if you make them divide earlier, what happens is that an SOP divides, it stops signaling to its neighbors because they lose protrusion, they no longer signal to their neighbors. But what happens is that new SOPs appear all over the place, and so you start to get a real mess in the model. So this suggests, anyway, that the potential that the coupling is quite important because it enables cells that receive a strong notch signal to make up their mind quickly. Cells that receive a weak one can change their mind. And it also ensures that the SOP cells go last. And so one thing we could do to look at that anyway in flies was just to drive, we could at least test this. So if we drive CC25 or string expression early on in the SOP cells, what we can see is that now you get a bit of a mess. You get lots of these doublets, which we would say are similar to a case where one SOP goes into division and a neighboring cell then can come up. And we see that in some cases, that we see that in wild-type tissue as well, where an SOP cell will divide and then a neighbor will appear because it hasn't then been inhibited, and you get these sometimes in the clusters. So here's a case where this cell has been driven into division prematurely, and this cell, which looked like an epithelial cell, starts to express the neuralizer port, and it's quite close. And that's how you get these sort of doublets. So we think that there is this, that it's important, that's our hypothesis, to couple division and...
In the reverse experiment,
yes,
when you knock string down, do you get the sparse...
If we knock string down, you get very few... you get very few divisions at all. So in a way, what happens is, in fact, if you don't get divisions, the pattern can actually, and you get this in the model, if there's no divisions at all, the patterning is quite good. Because the problem happens, so what we couldn't do, what you need to do is you need to drive random cell divisions independently of notch
cell signaling. If the pattern is quite good without divisions, why do you think there's a role for divisions?
Because, yeah, so that's a very good question. So essentially, if you in all the previous simulations I showed you, which Michael did, if you have no division in the tissue, the pattern works quite well, because essentially all cells compete and it settles quickly. But we know that in the tissue you have to have divisions, because you have to build a mechanosensory organ which divides. And when these cells divide, I mean, this is a bit, you know, you could say it's a ridiculous argument, but essentially we do know that those cells in the tissue have to divide to build the organ. When they divide, they can't sequence their neighbours. And so we'd argue that you're going to have divisions to do anything. If you have divisions of these cells, as soon as they divide, they're not going to sequence their neighbours. So all, you're going to get this effect. If only the SOP cells divide, you get this.
If they divide early.
No, but also if they're the only ones that divide, that then becomes early. If nobody divides except SOP cells, then you get this. Unless there's a way of switching off fate that's completely separate to sealing fate that's independent of division.
Well, but yeah, that's the conventional explanation, isn't it?
That there is a...
Yeah, that you seal fate by turning off a key skew.
But in this tissue, what we see is that it looks like that division is the thing that switches off the that really switches off the decision. So we're arguing that
in the non-SOP cells.
Yeah.
So they contain they're still expressing a key skew right up until they divide.
But they can switch, but as soon as an SOP cell, but I suppose that's the switching thing, that if an SOP cell disappears, they can come up, they can change their...
But that does become irreversible at a certain point.
Well, except we think that this is actually not, at the final time point when the SOP cells go, it's not determined, actually. So we would argue that the way the tissue's set up is wired, I mean, it could be wired such that epithelial cells seal their fate late, but we think that in this tissue it's wired such that division is the thing that does it. And therefore, you have to get the division coupling right in order to...
Division of the non-SOP cells.
Yeah, yeah. And also, the other thing that I like about this idea, this is sort of the idea, that it's a game, right? The notched outer pattern is a game. You have a blank tissue, you want to pattern it. And you want to pattern it quite quickly. So what you do is that you have a period, which is an extended G2 period, where you play the game. And that's the period you have. And as soon as you exit into mitosis, the game is over. And the idea would be to pattern well, quickly. And we haven't sort of formally done this in the model, a bit in the model, but that's the idea. So notch signaling drives you into division. The way the notch signal works is that it's sort of high between neighbouring cells and it's a bit less high between secondary neighbouring cells. The cells that receive the no notch input, the SOP cells, they have a fixed time of division. Which somehow are separate systems. That ends the game when they divide, and that appears to be the case. So even if you move C25, they all divide at the same time, so it seems to be a separate system. And cells stop signaling when they divide. So I suppose the idea is that you have equivalence pool. Cells start to express an option delta. When a cell is next to a cell that expresses high-level delta, it divides, and it no longer plays in the game. So it's patterned. That cell is patterned, it's fixed. But you leave some cells which are further away, which have a chance to switch their fate. Like this one here, which is a bit further away, it can switch to become an SOP cell, and it can only do that before it's divided, and as soon as it's divided, it can't. And so that's essentially... So we think that what this system gives you is a way to seal the fate of cells who get a very strong signal, and the ones that don't get a strong signal don't know who they are. They play the game longer until everything is finished. And that's how you get this pattern refinement. Boris is looking very confused.
I thought that this modulation of the time of cell division with a fairly small effect, as in 20% effect. But this cartoon picture sort of presents it as sort of almost sort of deterministic.
Oh, yeah. Well, no. Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah. Yes, okay. Yes.
And not terribly strong bias.
It's true. I mean, this is, yeah. So the complete, so I said, if you have no divisions at all, system patterns quite well. If you have completely uncoupled, the pattern's okay, a bit sparse. And if you drive SOPs early is a problem. That creates a real problem, because then cells come up in the wrong place. But it's true that, yes, I mean, this is an extra system in place. That, and in fact, even in the wild type, we're only seeing, you know, when all the way, we've been talking about a few cells that change their mind, which is like, you know, 10, 20 cells in area, which we see with a few hundred cells. So it's not a huge, it's absolutely not a huge effect. So I don't want to, you to go away thinking that this is a dominant thing. But I do think that in this tissue, we do think that cell division is coupled to patterning, and we think that it performs some role in this way, because in development, you do have limited periods of time in which you have to do stuff, and it just helps you achieve this. And the other nice thing about the system is that if you don't have notched delta signaling happening, the tissue's not being patterned, division will be delayed. So it's a way of coupling two processes, so you just have enough time in G2 to finish the pattern. So that's how we look at it in a simple way.
So this may have been so the next question, but how does rule 5 work?
So one thing, for SOP cells, they lose protrusions and they also do these other divisions, so, and they signal to each other. So that makes sense why they wouldn't send a signal. How epithelial division seals fate, I think, is we have no data about. We just see that the notch reporter starts to decline, but again, like in Ostomadov, we haven't properly measured the exact, you know, figured out whether
it's correlated with division, but is it really dependent on division?
So I'm just thinking about when you prematurely drive division, it also, yeah, it goes down earlier, and if you delay division, it goes up. So we do think it is actually causal, yeah. But I think it's a very interesting question why division itself should change. And I think that's a very important question, asymmetric divisions, how you couple,
exactly.
Which happens all the time.
You know, in the cell that we're talking about, the SOPs,
yeah.
When they divide,
yeah.
There's that signaling
exactly, yes,
exactly
yes.
There. So it's not that there's no
yeah.
Signaling when they divide.
No, yeah, yeah.
It's just a different kind of
yes, yeah.
But it's the
epithelial
loss of response for the epithelial cells, which is
yeah.
Key.
Yeah. But I think it could be.
But that's tricky because you cannot invoke anymore some biochemistry that happens in those cells because those cells make the biochemistry of signaling. Meaning,
yeah.
You know, they have the cell biochemistry of signaling. Things are expressed, things are ubiquitinated, things are doing the whole job. So it's not just the biochemistry of signaling; it's something else.
How far are you from a logical finish line?
Well, I was going to, that was half the story. I've got this whole thing about, so I finished this, and the other thing, this is part two. But shall I whiz through part two, identify in 10 minutes, and then, or shall I just stop, and then if someone can ask me.
12 and quarter past 12.
Okay.
So we probably need to pop out. Right?
Okay. So may I just tell you, shall I just tell you briefly what part two is about, or not?
I think that's a good idea, and then we can perhaps schedule another time in the afternoon.
Okay. If people are interested, so yeah.
Yeah.
Or people can just come to me.
We get an advert now.
Yeah, just do
okay, an advert. Okay. Yeah. So the advert is, so as you will have, I think you've heard at this meeting, there are neighbor exchange is where cells change. Where cells change neighbors in a tissue is an important process in many tissues, and it drives morphogenesis in, for example, the early Drosophila embryo. And so so the idea is that in many tissues, you recruit myosin. You've heard this, right? You recruit myosin to junctions, they shrink, and then they disappear, and then you elongate them in the other way, and that way you get germ bank elongation. And so to do this, you have to remove certain junctions with the particular orientation, then you reform other ones, you have to contract and expand, and the way you do this is you polarize the tissue by polarized myosin. And this this really leads to changes in tissue mass, and is a major morphogenetic event, and many, many people, including some people here, have contributed to this work to do that. And so we just wanted to know in the notum, this tissue I've told it, which is a bit boring, there's not much morphogenesis, what happens, and this was the work of Scott and Charlotte, and I won't. And basically what we see is that there is myosin 2 on junctions, there is fluctuations in junction length and neighbor exchange. And the question we wanted to ask is that what is neighbor exchange like in this tissue, and what is the role of myosin? And in a way, perhaps not surprisingly, because the tissue doesn't go through big morphogenesis, what we've shown, which I can talk about next time, is really that myosin does the same molecular job. So when myosin is on a junction, it shortens that junction a bit. And when you remove myosin, the junction expands. But myosin in this tissue is isotropic. It's not polarized. So what we find is in the tissue that the more myosin you have, because you get tension across the tissue in 2D, it actually does the opposite. It stops neighbor exchange. And over developmental time, what happens is the myosin levels increase and increase, and neighbor exchange rates go down and down and down, and the tissue becomes more solid and less dynamic and well ordered, because myosin tension also helps to ensure that all the junctions are uniform in lengths. So in this tissue, it looks completely different. And so our idea is, I'll just cut to the end. Look. Yeah. So basically what we think again, in this tissue, where there's myosin all over, it looks like myosin does a different thing. It stops neighbor exchange, and it just helps to order the tissue. And that's it. So I can take more detail. So basically, and just to find out, I just wanted one more Hokusai. This is the other wrestling photo. But I also like Hokusai because it's about physics coming together with biology. These are people rowing in a boat. And that's the hard thing about biology, because it's not just about, as you all know, it's not just about mechanics and self-organization. It's also about genes doing stuff in cells. And so I think that's what's so fascinating. And I really have to thank collaborators, and I don't know who's, you know, I guess all of us are working in collaborations, and I think it's a bit like this. That's the other reason I had the thing, because a good collaboration, I think, is a bit like wrestling, where you don't just say, I'm looking for a figure 7 for my paper, can you just do a model and we'll put it in? Many of us have thought about doing those and have some things a bit like that. I can point you to the papers, which I think of mine, are more like that. But a good collaboration is where you struggle and fight and find a way to, and you're reconciling an idea, after idea, with reality, which is hard. And so for me, I mean, some people, you know, who do more quantitative models struggle with this much more directly. But for myself, I think it's a very useful dialogue, and it's really inspiring and helps. But I think it's still, we always have an idea and the data, and we're trying to reconcile them. But whether we actually really, they meet is another question. I think we have to keep doing these things and remodeling, and maybe taking some of the models I talked about and making them more quantitative and really testing them. But still, there are ideas, and you could explain data in other ways. But I should thank the people who've done the work. So Michael and Marios started off doing this notched delta signaling project, and then Ginger and the brilliant Zena have helped take that further. Eliana really started looking at neighbor exchange, and these people all helped with that project, but they didn't really talk about that. And thank you for all the great questions and ideas, and it's really great to be here. Thank you.